many real-world judgments and beliefs, including belief in ghosts, astrology, and extrasensory perception. The scores predict whether people will fall for blatantly inaccurate fake news. They are even associated with how much people will use their smartphones. The CRT is seen by many as one instrument to measure a broader concept: the propensity to use reflective versus impulsive thought processes. Simply put, some people like to engage in careful thought, whereas others, faced with the same problem, tend to trust their first impulses. In our terminology, the CRT can be seen as a measure of people's propensity to rely on slow System 2 thinking rather than on fast System 1 thinking. Other self-assessments have been developed to measure this propensity, and all these tests are, of course, intercorrelated. The Need for Cognition Scale, for instance, asks people how much they like to think hard about problems. To score high on the scale, you would have to agree that I tend to set goals that can be accomplished only by expending considerable mental effort, and disagree with thinking is not my idea of fun. People with a high need for cognition tend to be less susceptible to known cognitive biases. Some more bizarre associations have been reported too. If you avoid movie reviews with a spoiler alert, you probably have a high need for cognition. Those who are low on the need for cognition scale prefer spoiled stories. Because that scale is a self-assessment, and because the socially desirable answer is fairly obvious, the scale raises fair questions. Someone who is trying to impress is hardly likely to endorse the statement, "Thinking is not my idea of fun." For that reason, other tests try to measure skills instead of using self-descriptions. One example is the Adult Decision-Making Competence Scale, which measures how prone people are to make typical errors in judgment, like overconfidence or inconsistency in risk perceptions. Another is the Halpern Critical Thinking Assessment, which focuses on critical thinking skills, including both a disposition toward rational thinking and a set of learnable skills. Taking this assessment, you would be asked questions like this. Imagine that a friend asks you for advice about which of two weight loss programs to choose. Whereas one program reports that clients lose an average of 25 pounds, the other program reports that they lose an average of 30 pounds. What questions would you like to have answered before choosing one of the programs? If you answered, for instance, that you would want to know how many people lost this much weight, and whether they maintained that weight loss for a year or more, you would score points for applying critical thinking. People who score well on the Adult Decision-Making Competence Scale, or on the Halpern Assessment, seem to make better judgments in life. They experience fewer adverse life events driven by bad choices, such as needing to pay late fees for a movie rental, and experiencing an unwanted pregnancy. It seems sensible to assume that all these measures of cognitive style and skill, and many others, generally predict judgment. Their relevance seems, however, to vary with the task. When Uriel Haran, Ilana Ritoff, and Barbara Mellers looked for the cognitive styles that might predict forecasting ability, they found that the need for cognition did not predict who would work harder to seek additional information. They also did not find that the need for cognition was reliably associated with higher performance. The only measure of cognitive style or personality that they found to predict forecasting performance was another scale, developed by psychology professor Jonathan Baron to measure actively open-minded thinking. To be actively open-minded is to actively search for information that contradicts your pre-existing hypotheses. Such information includes the dissenting opinions of others and the careful weighing of new evidence against old beliefs. Actively open-minded people agree with statements like this: allowing oneself to be convinced by an opposing argument is a sign of good character. They disagree with the proposition that changing your mind is a sign of weakness, or that intuition is the best guide in making decisions. In other words, while the cognitive reflection and need for cognition scores measure the propensity to engage in slow and careful thinking, actively open-minded thinking goes beyond that. It is the humility of those who are constantly aware that their judgment is a work in progress and who yearn to be corrected. We will see in Chapter 21 that this thinking style characterizes the very best forecasters, who constantly change their minds and revise their beliefs in response to new information. Interestingly, there is some evidence that actively open-minded thinking is a teachable skill. We do not aim here to draw hard and fast conclusions about how to pick individuals who will make good judgments in a given domain. But two general principles emerge from this brief review. First, it is wise to recognize the difference between domains in which expertise can be confirmed by comparison with true values, such as weather forecasting, and domains that are the province of respect experts. A political analyst may sound articulate and convincing, and a chess grandmaster may sound timid and unable to explain the reasoning behind some of his moves. Yet we probably should treat the professional judgment of the former with more skepticism than that of the latter. Second, some judges are going to be better than their equally qualified and experienced peers. If they are better, they are less likely to be biased or noisy. Among many things that explain these differences, intelligence and cognitive style matter. Although no single measure or scale unambiguously predicts judgment quality, you may want to look for the sort of people who actively search for new information that could contradict their prior beliefs, who are methodical in integrating that information into their current perspective, and who are willing, even eager, to change their minds as a result. The personality of people with excellent judgment may not fit the generally accepted stereotype of a decisive leader. People often tend to trust and like leaders who are firm and clear and who seem to know immediately and deep in their bones what is right. Such leaders inspire confidence. But the evidence suggests that if the goal is to reduce error, it is better for leaders and others to remain open to counterarguments and to know that they might be wrong. If they end up being decisive, it is at the end of a process, not at the start. Speaking of better judges, you are an expert, but are your judgments verifiable, or are you a respect expert? We have to choose between two opinions, and we know nothing about these individuals' expertise and track record. Let's follow the advice of the more intelligent one. Intelligence is only part of the story, however. How people think is also important. Perhaps we should pick the most thoughtful, open-minded person rather than the smartest one. Chapter 19, Debiasing and Decision Hygiene. Many researchers and organizations have pursued the goal of debiasing judgments. This chapter examines their central findings. We will distinguish between different types of debiasing interventions and discuss one such intervention that deserves further investigation. We will then turn to the reduction of noise and introduce the idea of decision hygiene. Ex post and ex ante debiasing. A good way to characterize the two main approaches to debiasing is to return to the measurement analogy. Suppose that you know that your bathroom scale adds, on average, 0.5 pound to your weight. Your scale is biased, but this does not make it useless. You can address its bias in one of two possible ways. You can correct every reading from your unkindly scale by subtracting 0.5 pound. To be sure, that might get a bit tiresome and you might forget to do it. An alternative might be to adjust the dial and improve the instrument's accuracy once and for all. These two approaches to debiasing measurements have direct analogs in interventions to debias judgments. They work either ex post by correcting judgments after they have been made, or ex ante by intervening before a judgment or decision. Ex post, or corrective, debiasing is often carried out intuitively. Suppose that you are supervising a team in charge of a project and that the team estimates that it can complete its project in 3 months. You might want to add a buffer to the member's judgment and plan for 4 months or more thus correcting a bias, the planning fallacy, you assume is present. This kind of bias correction is sometimes undertaken more systematically. In the United Kingdom, HM Treasury has published The Green Book, a guide on how to evaluate programs and projects. The book urges planners to address optimistic biases by applying percentage adjustments to estimates of the cost and duration of a project. These adjustments should ideally be based on an organization's historic levels of optimism bias. If no such historical data is available, the Green Book recommends applying generic adjustment percentages for each type of project. Ex-ante or preventive debiasing interventions fall in turn into two broad categories. Some of the most promising are designed to modify the environments in which the judgment or decision takes place. Such modifications, or nudges as they are known, aim to reduce the effect of biases, or even to enlist biases to produce a better decision. A simple example is automatic enrollment in pension plans. Designed to overcome inertia, procrastination, and optimistic bias, automatic enrollment ensures that employees will be saving for retirement unless they deliberately opt out. Automatic enrollment has proved to be extremely effective in increasing participation rates. The program is sometimes accompanied by Save More Tomorrow plans, by which employees can agree to earmark a certain percentage of their future wage increases for savings. Automatic enrollment can be used in many places. For example, automatic enrollment in green energy, in free school meal plans for poor children, or in various other benefits programs. Other nudges work on different aspects of choice architecture. They might make the right decision the easy decision. For example, by reducing administrative burdens for getting access to care for mental health problems. Or they might make certain characteristics of a product or an activity salient. For example, by making once hidden fees explicit and clear. Grocery stores and websites can easily be designed to nudge people in a way that overcomes their biases. If healthy foods are put in prominent places, more people are likely to buy them. A different type of ex-ante debiasing involves training decision makers to recognize their biases and to overcome them. Some of these interventions have been called boosting. They aim to improve people's capacities, for example, by teaching them statistical literacy. Educating people to overcome their biases is an honorable enterprise, but it is more challenging than it seems. Of course, education is useful. For instance, people who have taken years of advanced statistics classes are less likely to make errors in statistical reasoning. But teaching people to avoid biases is hard. Decades of research have shown that professionals who have learned to avoid biases in their area of expertise often struggle to apply what they have learned to different fields. Weather forecasters, for instance, have learned to avoid overconfidence in their forecasts. When they announce a 70% chance of rain, it rains by and large 70% of the time. Yet they can be just as overconfident as other people when asked general knowledge questions. The challenge of learning to overcome a bias is to recognize that a new problem is similar to one we have seen elsewhere, and that a bias that we have seen in one place is likely to materialize in other places. Researchers and educators have had some success using non-traditional teaching methods to facilitate this recognition. In one study, Cary Morwedge of Boston University and his colleagues used instructional videos and serious games. Participants learned to recognize errors caused by confirmation bias, anchoring, and other psychological biases. After each game, they received feedback on the errors they had made and learned how to avoid making them again. The games, and to a lesser extent the videos, reduced the number of errors that participants made on a test immediately afterward and again 8 weeks later, when they were asked similar questions. In a separate study, Anne-Laure Cellier and her colleagues found that MBA students who had played an instructional video game in which they learned to overcome confirmation bias applied this learning when solving a business case in another class. They did so even though they were not told that there was any connection between the two exercises. A limitation of debiasing. Whether they correct biases ex post or prevent their effects through nudging or boosting, most debiasing approaches have one thing in common. They target a specific bias which they assume is present. This often reasonable assumption is sometimes wrong. Consider again the example of project planning. You can reasonably assume that overconfidence affects project teams in general, but you cannot be sure that it is the only bias, or even the main one, affecting a particular project team. Maybe the team leader has had a bad experience with a similar project, and so has learned to be especially conservative when making estimates. The team thus exhibits the opposite error from the one you thought you should correct. Or perhaps the team developed its forecast by analogy with another similar project, and was anchored on the time it took to complete that project. Or maybe the project team, anticipating that you would add a buffer to its estimate, has preempted your adjustment by making its recommendation even more bullish than its true belief. Or consider an investment decision. Overconfidence about the investment's prospects may certainly be at work, but another powerful bias, loss aversion, has the opposite effect, making decision makers loath to risk losing their initial outlay. Or consider a company allocating resources across multiple projects. Decision makers may be both bullish about the effect of new initiatives, overconfidence again, and too timid in diverting resources from existing units, a problem caused by status quo bias, which, as the name indicates, is our preference for leaving things as they are. As these examples illustrate, it is difficult to know exactly which psychological biases are affecting a judgment. In any situation of some complexity, multiple psychological biases may be at work, conspiring to add error in the same direction or offsetting one another with unpredictable consequences. The upshot is that ex post or ex ante debiasing, which respectfully correct or prevent specific psychological biases, are useful in some situations. These approaches work where the general direction of error is known and manifests itself as a clear statistical bias. Types of decisions that are expected to be strongly biased are likely to benefit from debiasing interventions. For instance, the planning fallacy is a sufficiently robust finding to warrant debiasing interventions against overconfident planning. The problem is that in many situations, the likely direction of error is not known in advance. Such situations include all those in which the effect of psychological biases is variable among judges and essentially unpredictable, resulting in system noise. To reduce error under circumstances like these, we need to cast a broader net to try to detect more than one psychological bias at a time. The decision observer. We suggest undertaking this search for biases neither before nor after the decision is made, but in real time. Of course, people are rarely aware of their own biases when they are being misled by them. This lack of awareness is itself a known bias, the bias blind spot. People often recognize biases more easily in others than they do in themselves. We suggest that observers can be trained to spot in real time the diagnostic signs that one or several familiar biases are affecting someone else's decisions or recommendations. To illustrate how the process might work, imagine a group that attempts to make a complex and consequential judgment. The judgment could be of any type. A government deciding on possible responses to a pandemic or other crisis, a case conference in which physicians are exploring the best treatment for a patient with complex symptoms, a corporate board deciding on a major strategic move. Now imagine a decision observer, someone who watches this group and uses a checklist to diagnose whether any biases may be pushing the group away from the best possible judgment. A decision observer is not an easy role to play, and no doubt in some organizations it is not realistic. Detecting biases is useless if the ultimate decision makers are not committed to fighting them. Indeed, the decision makers must be the ones who initiate the process of decision observation and who support the role of the decision observer. We certainly do not recommend that you make yourself a self-appointed decision observer. You will neither win friends nor influence people. Informal experiments suggest, however, that real progress can be made with this approach. At least, the approach is helpful under the right conditions, especially when the leaders of an organization or team are truly committed to the effort, and when the decision observers are well chosen and not susceptible to serious biases of their own. Decision observers in these cases fall in three categories. In some organizations, the role can be played by a supervisor. Instead of monitoring only the substance of the proposals that are submitted by a project team, the supervisor might also pay close attention to the process by which they are developed and to the team's dynamics. This makes the observer alert to biases that may have affected the proposal's development. Other organizations might assign a member of each working team to be the team's bias buster. This guardian of decision process reminds teammates in real time of the biases that may mislead them. The downside of this approach is that the decision observer is placed in the position of a devil's advocate inside the team and may quickly run out of political capital. Finally, other organizations might rely on an outside facilitator who has the advantage of a neutral perspective and the attending disadvantages in terms of inside knowledge and cost. To be effective, decision observers need some training and tools. One such tool is a checklist of the biases they are attempting to detect. The case for relying on a checklist is clear. Checklists have a long history of improving decisions in high-stakes contexts and are particularly well-suited to preventing the repetition of past errors. Here is an example. In the United States, federal agencies must compile a formal regulatory impact analysis before they issue expensive regulations designed to clean the air or water, reduce deaths in the workplace, increase food safety, respond to public health crises, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, or increase homeland security. A dense technical document with an unlovely name, OMB Circular A-4, and spanning nearly 50 pages, sets out the requirements of the analysis. The requirements are clearly designed to counteract bias. Agencies must explain why the regulation is needed, consider both more and less stringent alternatives, consider both costs and benefits, present the information in an unbiased manner, and discount the future appropriately. But in many agencies, government officials have not complied with the requirements of that dense technical document. They might not even have read it. In response, federal officials produced a simple checklist, consisting of just 1.5 pages, to reduce the risk that agencies will ignore or fail to attend to any of the major requirements. To illustrate what a bias checklist might look like, we have included one as Appendix B on the bonus PDF. This generic checklist is merely an example. Any decision observer will certainly want to develop one that is customized to the needs of the organization, both to enhance its relevance and facilitate its adoption. Importantly, a checklist is not an exhaustive list of all the biases that can affect a decision. It aims to focus on the most frequent and most consequential ones. Decision observation with appropriate bias checklists can help limit the effect of biases. Although we have seen some encouraging results in informal, small-scale efforts, we are not aware of any systematic exploration of the effects of this approach or of the pros and cons of the various possible ways to deploy it. We hope to inspire more experimentation, both by practitioners and by researchers, of the practice of real-time debiasing by decision observers. Noise reduction, decision hygiene. Bias is error we can often see and even explain. It is directional. That is why a nudge can limit the detrimental effects of a bias, or why an effort to boost judgment can combat specific biases. It is also often visible. That is why an observer can hope to diagnose biases in real time, as a decision is being made. Noise, on the other hand, is unpredictable error that we cannot easily see or explain. That is why we so often neglect it, even when it causes grave damage. For this reason, strategies for noise reduction are to debiasing what preventive hygiene measures are to medical treatment. The goal is to prevent an unspecified range of potential errors before they occur. We call this approach to noise reduction decision hygiene. When you wash your hands, you may not know precisely which germ you are avoiding. You just know that hand washing is good prevention for a variety of germs, especially but not only during a pandemic. Similarly, following the principles of decision hygiene means that you adopt techniques that reduce noise without ever knowing which underlying errors you are helping to avoid. The analogy with hand washing is intentional. Hygiene measures can be tedious. Their benefits are not directly visible. You might never know what problem they prevented from occurring. Conversely, when problems do arise, they may not be traceable to a specific breakdown in hygiene observance. For these reasons, hand-washing compliance is difficult to enforce, even among healthcare professionals who are well aware of its importance. Just like hand-washing and other forms of prevention, decision hygiene is invaluable but thankless. Correcting a well-identified bias may at least give you a tangible sense of achieving something, but the procedures that reduce noise will not. They will statistically prevent many errors, yet you will never know which errors. Noise is an invisible enemy, and preventing the assault of an invisible enemy can yield only an invisible victory. Given how much damage noise can cause, that invisible victory is nonetheless worth the battle. The following chapters introduce several decision hygiene strategies used in multiple domains, including forensic science, forecasting, medicine, and human resources. In Chapter 25, we will review these strategies and show how they can be combined in an integrated approach to noise reduction. Speaking of debiasing and decision hygiene, do you know what specific bias you're fighting and in what direction it affects the outcome? If not, there are probably several biases at work, and it is hard to predict which one will dominate. Before we start discussing this decision, let's designate a decision observer. We have kept good decision hygiene in this decision process. Chances are the decision is as good as it can be. Chapter 20. Sequencing Information in Forensic Science. In March 2004, a series of bombs placed in commuter trains killed 192 people and injured more than 2,000 in Madrid. A fingerprint found on a plastic bag at the crime scene was transmitted via Interpol to law enforcement agencies worldwide. Days later, the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, crime lab, conclusively identified the fingerprint as belonging to Brandon Mayfield, an American citizen living in Oregon. Mayfield looked like a plausible suspect. A former officer in the U.S. Army, he had married an Egyptian woman and converted to Islam. As a lawyer, he had represented men charged with, and later convicted of, attempting to travel to Afghanistan to join the Taliban. He was on the FBI's watch list. Mayfield was placed under surveillance, his house bugged and searched, his phones wiretapped. When this scrutiny failed to yield any material information, the FBI arrested him. But he was never formally charged. Mayfield had not left the country in a decade. While he was in custody, the Spanish investigators, who had already informed the FBI that they considered Mayfield a negative match for the fingerprint on the plastic bag, matched that print to another suspect. Mayfield was released after 2 weeks. Eventually, the U.S. government apologized to him, paid him a $2 million settlement, and ordered an extensive investigation into the causes of the mistake. Its key finding: the error was a human error, and not a methodology or technology failure. Fortunately, such human errors are rare. They are nonetheless instructive. How could the best fingerprint experts in the United States mistakenly identify a fingerprint as belonging to a man who had never come close to the crime scene? To find out, we first need to understand how fingerprint examination works and how it relates to other examples of professional judgment. We will learn that forensic fingerprinting, which we tend to think of as an exact science, is in fact subject to the psychological biases of examiners. These biases can create more noise and thus more error than we would imagine. And we will see how the forensic science community is taking steps to tackle this problem by implementing a decision hygiene strategy that can apply to all environments, a tight control over the flow of information used to make judgments. Fingerprints. Finger marks are the impressions left by the friction ridges of our fingers on the surfaces we touch. Although there are examples of fingerprints being used as apparent identification marks in ancient times, modern fingerprinting dates back to the late 19th century, when Henry Faulds, a Scottish physician, published the first scientific paper suggesting the use of fingerprints as an identification technique. In subsequent decades, fingerprints gained traction as identification marks in criminal records, gradually replacing the anthropometric measurement techniques developed by Alphonse Bertillon, a French police officer. Bertillon himself codified in 1912 a formal system for the comparison of fingerprints. Sir Francis Galton, whom we previously encountered as the discoverer of the wisdom of crowds, had developed a similar system in England. Still, it is no wonder that these founding fathers are rarely celebrated. Galton believed that fingerprints would be a useful tool for classifying individuals according to their race, and Bertillon, probably because of anti-Semitic prejudice, contributed decisive and flawed expert testimony during the 1894 and 1899 trials of Alfred Dreyfus. Police officers soon discovered that fingerprints could do more than serve as identification marks for repeat offenders. In 1892, Juan Vucetich, a police officer in Argentina, was the first to compare a latent fingerprint left at a crime scene with a suspect's thumb. Since then, the practice of collecting latent prints, those left by their owner at the scene of a crime, and comparing them with exemplar prints, those collected in controlled conditions from known individuals, has been the most decisive application of fingerprinting and has provided the most widely used form of forensic evidence. If you have ever come across an electronic fingerprint reader like those used by immigration services in many countries, you probably think of fingerprint comparison as a straightforward, mechanical, and easily automated task. But comparing a latent print collected from a crime scene with an exemplar print is a much more delicate exercise than matching two clean prints. When you press your fingers firmly on a reader purposely built to record a fingerprint impression, you produce a neat, standardized image. By contrast, latent prints are often partial, unclear, smudged, or otherwise distorted. They do not provide the same quantity and quality of information as does a print collected in a controlled and dedicated environment. Latent prints often overlap with other prints, either by the same person or by someone else, and include dirt and other artifacts present on the surface. Deciding whether they match a suspect's exemplar prints requires expert judgment. It is the job of human fingerprint examiners. When provided with a latent print, examiners routinely follow a process called ACE-V, which stands for Analysis, Comparison, Evaluation, and Verification. First, they must analyze the latent print to determine whether it is of sufficient value for comparison. If it is, they compare it to an exemplar print. The comparison leads to an evaluation, which can produce an identification. The prints originated from the same person, an exclusion, the prints do not originate from the same person, or an inconclusive decision. An identification decision triggers the fourth step, verification by another examiner. For decades, the reliability of this procedure remained unquestioned. Although eyewitness testimonies have been shown to be dangerously unreliable, and even confessions can be false, fingerprints were accepted, at least until the advent of DNA analysis, as the most credible form of evidence. Until 2002, fingerprint evidence had never been successfully challenged in an American courtroom. The FBI website at the time, for example, was adamant. Fingerprints offer an infallible means of personal identification. In the very rare cases when errors did happen, they were blamed on incompetence or fraud. Fingerprint evidence remained unchallenged for so long, in part because of the difficulty in proving it wrong. The true value of a set of fingerprints, that is, the ground truth of who actually committed the crime, is often unknown. For Mayfield and a handful of similar cases, the mistake was especially egregious. But in general, if a suspect disputes the examiner's conclusions, the fingerprint evidence will, of course, be considered more reliable. We have noted that not knowing the true value is neither unusual nor an impediment to measuring noise. How much noise is there in fingerprint analysis? Or more precisely, given that fingerprint examiners, unlike sentencing judges or underwriters, do not produce a number but make a categorical judgment, how often do they disagree and why? This question is what E.T.L. Dror, a cognitive neuroscience researcher at University College London, was the first to set out to study. He conducted what amounts to a series of noise audits in a field that had assumed it did not have a noise problem. Occasion noise in fingerprint analysis. It may seem odd for a cognitive scientist, a psychologist, to challenge fingerprint examiners. After all, as you may have seen on TV shows like CSI, Crime Scene Investigation, and subsequent series of the CSI franchise, these are latex glove-wearing, microscope-wielding hard science types. But Dror realized that examining fingerprints was clearly a matter of judgment. And as a cognitive neuroscientist, he reasoned that wherever there is judgment, there must be noise. To test this hypothesis, Dror focused first on occasion noise, the variability between the judgments of these same experts looking at the same evidence twice. As Dror puts it, if experts are not reliable in the sense that they are not consistent with themselves, then the basis of their judgments and professionalism is in question. Fingerprints provide a perfect testbed for an audit of occasion noise because, unlike the cases that a physician or a judge encounters, pairs of prints are not easily memorable. Of course, a suitable interval of time must be allowed to pass to ensure that examiners do not remember the prints. In Dror studies, some brave, open-minded experts agreed that, at any time in the next 5 years, they would take part in studies without their knowledge. Additionally, the experiment must happen in the course of the experts' routine casework, so that they are not aware that their skills are being tested. If, under these circumstances, the examiner's judgments change from one test to the next, we are in the presence of occasion noise. The forensic confirmation bias. In two of his original studies, Dror added an important twist. When seeing the prints for the second time, some of the examiners were exposed to additional biasing information about the case. For instance, fingerprint examiners who had earlier found the prints to be a match were told this time that the suspect has an alibi, or that firearms evidence suggests it's not him. Others who had first concluded that a suspect was innocent or that the prints were inconclusive were told the second time that the detective believes the suspect is guilty. Eyewitnesses identified him or he confessed to the crime. Dror called this experiment a test of the expert's bias ability because the contextual information supplied activated a psychological bias, a confirmation bias, in a given direction. Indeed, the examiners turned out to be susceptible to bias. When the same examiners considered the same prints they had seen earlier, but this time with biasing information, their judgments changed. In the first study, 4 out of 5 experts altered their previous identification decision when presented with strong contextual information that suggested an exclusion. In the second study, 6 experts reviewed 4 pairs of prints. Biasing information led to changes in 4 of the 24 decisions. To be sure, most of their decisions did not change, but for these kinds of decisions, a shift of 1 in 6 can be counted as large. These findings have since been replicated by other researchers. Predictably, the examiners were more likely to change their minds when the decision was a difficult one to start with, when the biasing information was strong, and when the change was from a conclusive to an inconclusive decision. It is nonetheless troubling that expert fingerprint examiners made decisions on the basis of the context, rather than on the basis of the actual information contained in the print. The effect of biasing information is not restricted to the examiner's conclusion. Identification, inconclusive, or exclusion. Biasing information actually changes what the examiner perceives, in addition to how that perception is interpreted. In a separate study, Dror and colleagues showed that examiners who have been placed in a biased context literally do not see the same things as those who have not been exposed to biasing information. When the latent print is accompanied by a target exemplar print, the examiners observe significantly fewer details, called minutiae, than they do when they see the latent print alone. A later independent study confirmed this conclusion and added that how it occurs is not obvious. Dror coined a term for the impact of biasing information, the forensic confirmation bias. This bias has since been documented with other forensic techniques, including blood pattern analysis, arson investigation, the analysis of skeletal remains, and forensic pathology. Even DNA analysis, widely regarded as the new gold standard in forensic science, can be susceptible to confirmation bias, at least when experts must assess complex DNA mixtures. The susceptibility of forensic experts to confirmation bias is not just a theoretical concern, because in reality, no systematic precautions are in place to make sure that forensic experts are not exposed to biasing information. Examiners often receive such information in the transmittal letters that accompany the evidence submitted to them. Examiners are also often in direct communication with police, prosecutors, and other examiners. Confirmation bias raises another problem. An important safeguard against errors built into the ACE-V procedure is the independent verification by another expert before an identification can be confirmed. But most often, only identifications are independently verified. The result is a strong risk of confirmation bias, as the verifying examiner knows that the initial conclusion was an identification. The verification step, therefore, does not provide the benefit normally expected from the aggregation of independent judgments, because verifications are not, in fact, independent. A cascade of confirmation biases seems to have been at work in the Mayfield case, in which not 2 but 3 FBI experts concurred on the erroneous identification. As the later investigation of the error noted, the first examiner appears to have been impressed by the power of correlation from the automated system searching the databases of fingerprints for a possible match. Although he was, apparently, not exposed to Mayfield's biographical details, the results provided by the computerized system performing the initial search, coupled with the inherent pressure of working an extremely high-profile case, were enough to produce the initial confirmation bias. Once the first examiner made an erroneous identification, the report continues, the subsequent examinations were tainted. As the first examiner was a highly respected supervisor, it became increasingly difficult for others in the agency to disagree. The initial error was replicated and amplified, resulting in a near certainty that Mayfield was guilty. Tellingly, even a highly respected independent expert, appointed by the court to examine the evidence on behalf of Mayfield's defense, concurred with the FBI in confirming the identification. The same phenomenon can be at work in other forensic disciplines and across them. Latent print identification is reputed to be among the most objective of the forensic disciplines. If fingerprint examiners can be biased, so can experts in other fields. Moreover, if a firearms expert knows that the fingerprints are a match, this knowledge may bias that expert's judgment too. And if a forensic odontologist knows that DNA analysis has identified a suspect, that expert is probably less likely to suggest that the bite marks do not match the suspect. These examples raise the specter of bias cascades. Just as in the group decisions we described in Chapter 8, an initial error prompted by confirmation bias becomes the biasing information that influences a second expert, whose judgment biases a third one, and so on. Having established that biasing information creates variability, Drawer and his colleagues uncovered more evidence of occasion noise. Even when fingerprint experts are not exposed to biasing information, they sometimes change their minds about a set of prints they have seen before. As we would expect, changes are less frequent when no biasing information is supplied, but they happen nonetheless. A 2012 study commissioned by the FBI replicated this finding on a larger scale by asking 72 examiners to look again at 25 pairs of prints they had evaluated about 7 months earlier. With a large sample of highly qualified examiners, the study confirmed that fingerprint experts are sometimes susceptible to occasion noise. About one decision in 10 was altered. Most of the changes were to or from the inconclusive category, and none resulted in false identifications. The study's most troubling implication is that some fingerprint identifications that led to convictions could potentially have been judged inconclusive at another time. When the same examiners are looking at the same prints, even when the context is not designed to bias them but is instead meant to be as constant as possible, there is inconsistency in their decisions. Some noise, but how much error? The practical question raised by these findings is the possibility of judicial errors. We cannot ignore questions about the reliability of experts who testify in court. Validity requires reliability because, quite simply, it is hard to agree with reality if you cannot agree with yourself. How many errors exactly are caused by faulty forensic science? A review of 350 exonerations obtained by the Innocence Project, a nonprofit that works to overturn wrongful convictions, concluded that the misapplication of forensic science was a contributing cause in 45% of cases. This statistic sounds bad, but the question that matters to judges and jurors is different. To know how much trust they should accord the examiner taking the stand to testify, they need to know how likely forensic scientists, including fingerprint examiners, are to make consequential errors. The most robust set of answers to this question can be found in a report by the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, PCAST, an advisory group of the nation's leading scientists and engineers, which in 2016 produced an in-depth review of forensic science in criminal courts. The report summarizes the available evidence on the validity of fingerprint analysis and especially on the likelihood of erroneous identifications, false positives, such as the one involving Mayfield. This evidence is surprisingly sparse, and as PCAST notes, it is distressing that work to produce it did not begin until recently. The most credible data come from the only published large-scale study of fingerprint identification accuracy, which was conducted by FBI scientists themselves in 2011. The study involved 169 examiners, each comparing approximately 100 pairs of latent and exemplar fingerprints. Its central finding was that very few erroneous identifications occurred. the false positive rate was about 1 in 600. An error rate of 1 in 600 is low, but as the report noted, is much higher than the general public, and by extension, most jurors, would likely believe based on long-standing claims about the accuracy of fingerprint analysis. Furthermore, this study contained no biasing contextual information, and the participating examiners knew they were taking part in a test, which may have caused the study to underestimate the errors that occur in real casework. A subsequent study conducted in Florida arrived at much higher numbers of false positives. The varied findings in the literature suggest that we need more research on the accuracy of fingerprint examiner decisions and how these decisions are reached. One reassuring finding that does seem consistent across all studies, however, is that the examiners appear to err on the side of caution. Their accuracy is not perfect, but they are aware of the consequences of their judgments, and they take into account the asymmetrical cost of possible errors. Because of the very high credibility of fingerprinting, an erroneous identification can have tragic effects. Other types of error are less consequential. For instance, FBI experts observe, in most casework, an exclusion has the same operational implications as an inconclusive. In other words, the fact that a fingerprint is found on the murder weapon is sufficient to convict, but the absence of that print is not sufficient to exonerate a suspect. Consistent with our observation of examiner caution, the evidence suggests that experts think twice, or much more than twice, before making an identification decision. In the FBI study of identification accuracy, less than one-third of mated pairs, where the latent and the exemplar are from the same person, were judged accurately as identifications. Examiners also make far fewer false positive identifications than false negative exclusions. They are susceptible to bias, but not equally in both directions. As Drawer notes, it is easier to bias forensic experts towards the non-committal conclusion of inconclusive than to the definitive identification conclusion. Examiners are trained to consider erroneous identification as the deadly sin to be avoided at all costs. To their credit, they act in accordance with this principle. We can only hope that their level of care keeps erroneous identifications, like those in the Mayfield case, and a handful of other high-profile cases, extremely rare. Listening to noise. To observe that there is noise in forensic science should not be seen as a criticism of forensic scientists. It is merely a consequence of the observation we have made repeatedly. Wherever there is judgment, there is noise, and more of it than you think. A task like the analysis of fingerprints seems objective, so much so that many of us would not spontaneously regard it as a form of judgment. Yet, it leaves room for inconsistency, disagreement, and occasionally error. However low the error rate of fingerprint identification may be, it is not zero. And, as PCAST noted, juries should be made aware of that. The first step to reduce noise must be, of course, to acknowledge its possibility. This admission does not come naturally to members of the fingerprint community, many of whom were initially highly skeptical of Drawer's noise audit. The notion that an examiner can be unwittingly influenced by information about the case irked many experts. In a reply to Drawer's study, the chair of the Fingerprint Society wrote that any fingerprint examiner who is swayed either way in that decision-making process is so immature he or she should seek employment in Disneyland. A director of a major forensic laboratory noted that having access to case information, precisely the sort of information that could bias the examiner, provides some personal satisfaction which allows examiners to enjoy their job without actually altering their judgment. Even the FBI, in its internal investigation of the Mayfield case, noted that the latent print examiners routinely conduct verifications in which they know the previous examiner's results, and yet those results do not influence the examiner's conclusions. These remarks essentially amount to a denial of the existence of confirmation bias. Even when they are aware of the risk of bias, forensic scientists are not immune to the bias blind spot, the tendency to acknowledge the presence of bias in others but not in oneself. In a survey of 400 professional forensic scientists in 21 countries, 71% agreed that cognitive bias is a cause for concern in the forensic sciences as a whole, but only 26% thought that their own judgments are influenced by cognitive bias. In other words, about half of these forensic professionals believe that their colleagues' judgments are noisy, but that their own are not. Noise can be an invisible problem, even to people whose job is to see the invisible. Sequencing information. Thanks to the persistence of Dror and his colleagues, attitudes are slowly changing and a growing number of forensic laboratories have begun taking new measures to reduce error in their analyses. For example, the PCAST report commended the FBI laboratory for redesigning its procedures to minimize the risk of confirmation bias. The necessary methodological steps are relatively simple. They illustrate a decision hygiene strategy that has applicability in many domains. Sequencing information to limit the formation of premature intuitions. In any judgment, some information is relevant and some is not. More information is not always better, especially if it has the potential to bias judgments by leading the judge to form a premature intuition. In that spirit, the new procedures deployed in forensic laboratories aim to protect the independence of the examiner's judgments by giving the examiners only the information they need, when they need it. In other words, the laboratory keeps them as much in the dark about the case as possible and reveals information only gradually. To do that, the approach Dror and his colleagues codified is called linear sequential unmasking. Dror has another recommendation that illustrates the same decision hygiene strategy. Examiners should document their judgments at each step. They should document their analysis of a latent fingerprint before they look at exemplar fingerprints to decide whether they are a match. This sequence of steps helps experts avoid the risk that they see only what they are looking for, and they should record their judgment on the evidence before they have access to contextual information that risks biasing them. If they change their mind after they are exposed to contextual information, these changes and the rationale for them should be documented. This requirement limits the risk that an early intuition biases the entire process. The same logic inspires a third recommendation, which is an important part of decision hygiene. When a different examiner is called on to verify the identification made by the first person, the second person should not be aware of the first judgment. The presence of noise in forensic science is, of course, of concern because of its potential life or death consequences. But it is also revealing that we remained for so long entirely unaware of the possibility of error in fingerprint identification shows how our confidence in expert human judgment can sometimes be exaggerated, and how a noise audit can reveal an unexpected amount of noise. The ability to mitigate these shortcomings through relatively simple process changes should be encouraging to all those who care about improving the quality of decisions. The main decision hygiene strategy this case illustrates, sequencing information, has broad applicability as a safeguard against occasion noise. As we have noted, occasion noise is driven by countless triggers, including mood and even outside temperature. You cannot hope to control all these triggers, but you can attempt to shield judgments from the most obvious ones. You already know, for instance, that judgments can be altered by anger, fear, or other emotions, and perhaps you have noted that it is a good practice, if you can, to revisit your judgment at different points in time, when the triggers of occasion noise are likely to be different. Less obvious is the possibility that your judgment can be altered by another trigger of occasion noise, information, even when it is accurate information. As in the example of the fingerprint examiners, as soon as you know what others think, confirmation bias can lead you to form an overall impression too early and to ignore contradictory information. The titles of two Hitchcock movies sum it up. A good decision maker should aim to keep a shadow of a doubt, not to be the man who knew too much. Speaking of sequencing information, wherever there is judgment, there is noise, and that includes reading fingerprints. We have more information about this case, but let's not tell the experts everything we know before they make their judgment, so as not to bias them. In fact, let's tell them only what they absolutely need to know. The second opinion is not independent if the person giving it knows what the first opinion was, and the third one even less so. There can be a bias cascade. To fight noise, they first have to admit that it exists. Chapter 21. Selection and Aggregation in Forecasting. Many judgments involve forecasting. What is the unemployment rate likely to be in the next quarter? How many electric cars will be sold next year? What will be the effects of climate change in 2050? How long will it take to complete a new building? What will be the annual earnings of a particular company? How will a new employee perform? What will be the cost of a new air pollution regulation? Who will win an election? The answers to such questions have major consequences. Fundamental choices of private and public institutions often depend on them. Analysts of forecasting of when it goes wrong and why make a sharp distinction between bias and noise, also called inconsistency or unreliability. Everyone agrees that in some contexts, forecasters are biased. For example, official agencies show unrealistic optimism in their budget forecasts. On average, they project unrealistically high economic growth and unrealistically low deficits. For practical purposes, it matters little whether their unrealistic optimism is a product of a cognitive bias or political considerations. In addition, forecasters tend to be overconfident. If asked to formulate their forecasts as confidence intervals rather than as point estimates, they tend to pick narrower intervals than they should. For instance, an ongoing quarterly survey asks the chief financial officers of U.S. companies to estimate the annual return of the S&P 500 index for the next year. The CFOs provide two numbers, a minimum, below which they think there is a 1 in 10 chance the actual return will be, and a maximum, which they believe the actual return has a 1 in 10 chance of exceeding. Thus, the two numbers are the bounds of an 80% confidence interval. Yet the realized returns fall in that interval only 36% of the time. The CFOs are far too confident in the precision of their forecasts. Forecasters are also noisy. A reference text, J. Scott Armstrong's Principles of Forecasting, points out that even among experts, unreliability is a source of error in judgmental forecasting. In fact, noise is a major source of error. Occasion noise is common. Forecasters do not always agree with themselves. Between-person noise is also pervasive. Forecasters disagree with one another, even if they are specialists. If you ask law professors to predict Supreme Court rulings, you will find a great deal of noise. If you ask specialists to project the annual benefits of air pollution regulation, you will find massive variability, with ranges of, for example, $3 billion to $9 billion. If you ask a group of economists to make forecasts about unemployment and growth, you will also find great variability. We have already seen many examples of noisy forecasts, and research on forecasting uncovers many more. Improving forecasts. The research also offers suggestions for reducing noise and bias. We will not review them exhaustively here, but we will focus on two noise reduction strategies that have broad applicability. One is an application of the principle we mentioned in Chapter 18. Selecting better judges produces better judgments. The other is one of the most universally applicable decision hygiene strategies, aggregating multiple independent estimates. The easiest way to aggregate several forecasts is to average them. Averaging is mathematically guaranteed to reduce noise. Specifically, it divides it by the square root of the number of judgments averaged. This means that if you average 100 judgments, you will reduce noise by 90%. And if you average 400 judgments, you will reduce it by 95%, essentially eliminating it. This statistical law is the engine of the wisdom of crowds approach, discussed in Chapter 7. Because averaging does nothing to reduce bias, its effect on total error, MSE, depends on the proportions of bias and noise in it. That is why the wisdom of crowds works best when judgments are independent, and therefore less likely to contain shared biases. Empirically, ample evidence suggests that averaging multiple forecasts greatly increases accuracy. For instance, in the consensus forecast of economic forecasters of stock analysts. With respect to sales forecasting, weather forecasting, and economic forecasting, the unweighted average of a group of forecasters outperforms most and sometimes all individual forecasts. Averaging forecasts obtained by different methods has the same effect. In an analysis of 30 empirical comparisons in diverse domains, combined forecasts reduced errors by an average of 12.5%. Straight averaging is not the only way to aggregate forecasts. A select crowd strategy, which selects the best judges according to the accuracy of their recent judgments, and averages the judgments of a small number of judges, for example, 5, can be as effective as straight averaging. It is also easier for decision makers who respect expertise to understand and adopt a strategy that relies not only on aggregation, but also on selection. One method to produce aggregate forecasts is to use prediction markets, in which individuals bet on likely outcomes and are thus incentivized to make the right forecasts. Much of the time, prediction markets have been found to do very well in the sense that if the prediction market price suggests that events are, say, 70% likely to happen, they happen about 70% of the time. Many companies in various industries have used prediction markets to aggregate diverse views. Another formal process for aggregating diverse views is known as the Delphi method. In its classic form, this method involves multiple rounds during which the participants submit estimates or votes to a moderator and remain anonymous to one another. At each new round, the participants provide reasons for their estimates and respond to the reasons given by others, still anonymously. The process encourages estimates to converge, and sometimes forces them to do so by requiring new judgments to fall within a specific range of the distribution of previous round judgments. The method benefits both from aggregation and social learning. The Delphi method has worked well in many situations, but it can be challenging to implement. A simpler version, Mini-Delphi, can be deployed within a single meeting. Also called Estimate Talk Estimate, it requires participants first to produce separate and silent estimates, then to explain and justify them, and finally to make a new estimate in response to the estimates and explanations of others. The consensus judgment is the average of the individual estimates obtained in that second round. The Good Judgment Project. Some of the most innovative work on the quality of forecasting, going well beyond what we have explored thus far, started in 2011. When three prominent behavioral scientists founded the Good Judgment Project. Philip Tetlock, whom we encountered in Chapter 11, when we discussed his assessment of long-term forecasts of political events, his spouse, Barbara Mellers, and Don Moore, teamed up to improve our understanding of forecasting, and in particular, why some people are good at it. The Good Judgment Project started with the recruitment of tens of thousands of volunteers, not specialists or experts, but ordinary people from many walks of life. They were asked to answer hundreds of questions, such as these. Will North Korea detonate a nuclear device before the end of the year? Will Russia officially annex additional Ukrainian territory in the next 3 months? Will India or Brazil become a permanent member of the UN Security Council in the next 2 years? In the next year, will any country withdraw from the Eurozone? As these examples show, the project has focused on large questions about world events. Importantly, efforts to answer such questions raise many of the same problems that more mundane forecasts do. If a lawyer is asking whether a client will win in court, or if a television studio is asked whether a proposed show will be a big hit, forecasting skills are involved. Tetlock and his colleagues wanted to learn whether some people are especially good forecasters. They also wanted to learn whether the ability to forecast could be taught or at least improved. To understand the central findings, we need to explain some key aspects of the method adopted by Tetlock and his team to evaluate forecasters. First, they used a large number of forecasts, not just one or a few, where luck might be responsible for success or failure. If you predict that your favorite sports team will win its next game, and it does, you are not necessarily a good forecaster. Maybe you always predict that your favorite team will win. If that's your strategy, and if they win only half the time, your forecasting ability is not especially impressive. To reduce the role of luck, the researchers examined how participants did, on average, across numerous forecasts. Second, the researchers asked participants to make their forecasts in terms of probabilities that an event would happen, rather than a binary, it will happen, or it will not happen. To many people, forecasting means the latter, taking a stand one way or another. However, given our objective ignorance of future events, it is much better to formulate probabilistic forecasts. If someone said in 2016 Hillary Clinton is 70% likely to be elected president, he is not necessarily a bad forecaster. Things that are correctly said to be 70% likely will not happen 30% of the time. To know whether forecasters are good, we should ask whether their probability estimates map onto reality. Suppose that a particular forecaster named Margaret says that 500 different events are 60% likely. If 300 of them actually happen, then we can conclude that Margaret's confidence is well calibrated. Good calibration is one requirement for good forecasting. Third, as an added refinement, Tetlock and colleagues did not just ask their forecasters to make one probability estimate about whether an event would happen in, say, 12 months. They gave the participants the opportunity to revise their forecasts continuously in light of new information. Suppose that you had estimated back in 2016 that the United Kingdom had only a 30% chance of leaving the European Union before the end of 2019. As new polls came out, suggesting that the leave vote was gaining ground, you probably would have revised your forecast upward. When the result of the referendum was known, it was still uncertain whether the United Kingdom would leave the Union within that time frame, but it certainly looked a lot more probable. Brexit technically happened in 2020. With each new piece of information, Tetlock and his colleagues allowed the forecasters to update their forecasts. For scoring purposes, each one of these updates is treated as a new forecast. That way, participants in the Good Judgment Project are incentivized to monitor the news and update their forecasts continuously. This approach mirrors what is expected of forecasters in business and government, who should also be updating their forecasts frequently on the basis of new information, despite the risk of being criticized for changing their minds. A well-known response to this criticism, sometimes attributed to John Maynard Keynes, is, "When the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do?" Fourth, to score the performance of the forecasters, the Good Judgment Project used a system developed by Glenn W. Breyer in 1950. Breyer scores, as they are known, measure the distance between what people forecast and what actually happens. Breyer scores are a clever way to get around a pervasive problem associated with probabilistic forecasts: the incentive for forecasters to hedge their bets by never taking a bold stance. Think again of Margaret, whom we described as a well-calibrated forecaster because she rated 500 events as 60% likely, and 300 of those events did happen. This result may not be as impressive as it seems. If Margaret is a weather forecaster who always predicts a 60% chance of rain, and there are 300 rainy days out of 500, Margaret's forecasts are well calibrated, but also practically useless. Margaret, in essence, is telling you that, just in case, you might want to carry an umbrella every day. Compare her with Nicholas, who predicts a 100% chance of rain on the 300 days when it will rain, and a 0% chance of rain on the 200 dry days. Nicholas has the same perfect calibration as Margaret. When either forecaster predicts that X percent of the days will be rainy, rain falls precisely X percent of the time. But Nicholas's forecasts are much more valuable. Instead of hedging his bets, he is willing to tell you whether you should take an umbrella. Technically, Nicholas is said to have a high resolution in addition to good calibration. Breyer scores reward both good calibration and good resolution. To produce a good score, you have not only to be right on average, as in well calibrated, but also have to be willing to take a stand and differentiate among forecasts, as in have high resolution. Breyer scores are based on the logic of mean squared errors, and lower scores are better. A score of 0 would be perfect. So, now that we know how they were scored, how well did the Good Judgment Project volunteers do? One of the major findings was that the overwhelming majority of the volunteers did poorly, but about 2% stood out. As mentioned earlier, Tetlock calls these well-performing people super forecasters. They were hardly unerring, but their predictions were much better than chance. Remarkably, one government official said that the group did significantly better than the average for intelligence community analysts who could read intercepts and other secret data. This comparison is worth pausing over. Intelligence community analysts are trained to make accurate forecasts. They are not amateurs. In addition, they have access to classified information. And yet they do not do as well as the super forecasters do. Perpetual beta. What makes super forecasters so good? Consistent with our argument in Chapter 18, we could reasonably speculate that they are unusually intelligent. That speculation is not wrong. On GMA tests, the super forecasters do better than the average volunteer in the Good Judgment Project, and the average volunteer is significantly above the national average. But the difference isn't all that large, and many volunteers who do extremely well on intelligence tests do not qualify as super forecasters. Apart from general intelligence, we could reasonably expect that super forecasters are unusually good with numbers, and they are. But their real advantage is not their talent at math. It is their ease in thinking analytically and probabilistically. Consider super forecasters' willingness and ability to structure and disaggregate problems. Rather than form a holistic judgment about a big geopolitical question, whether a nation will leave the European Union, whether a war will break out in a particular place, whether a public official will be assassinated, they break it up into its component parts. They ask, what would it take for the answer to be yes? What would it take for the answer to be no? Instead of offering a gut feeling or some kind of global hunch, they ask and try to answer an assortment of subsidiary questions. Super forecasters also excel at taking the outside view, and they care a lot about base rates. As explained for the Gambardi problem in Chapter 13, before you focus on the specifics of Gambardi's profile, it helps to know the probability that the average CEO will be fired or quit in the next 2 years. Super forecasters systematically look for base rates. Asked whether the next year will bring an armed clash between China and Vietnam over a border dispute, super forecasters do not focus only or immediately on whether China and Vietnam are getting along right now. They might have an intuition about this in light of the news and analysis they have read. but they know that their intuition about one event is generally not a good guide. Instead, they start by looking for a base rate. They ask how often past border disputes have escalated into armed clashes. If such clashes are rare, superforecasters will begin by incorporating that fact, and only then turn to the details of the China-Vietnam situation. In short, what distinguishes the superforecasters isn't their sheer intelligence, it's how they apply it. The skills they bring to bear reflect the sort of cognitive style we described in Chapter 18 as likely to result in better judgments, particularly a high level of active open-mindedness. Recall the test for actively open-minded thinking. It includes such statements as people should take into consideration evidence that goes against their beliefs, and it is more useful to pay attention to people who disagree with you than to pay attention to those who agree. Clearly, people who score high on this test are not shy about updating their judgments without overreacting when new information becomes